From Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College.
This is War News Radio.
I'm Jared Nolan.
And I'm Cyrus Stoller.
This week on War News Radio, Reflections. We hear about the frustrations of a U.S. soldier in Iraq during his service in the early days of the war.
Then, we talk to a photojournalist about her experiences in Iraq at the start of the war.
Next, we explore how Afghanistan's schools are suffering from limited resources.
Finally, we learn about a charity skateboarding program in Afghanistan that is working to teach skateboarding skills and restore hope among Afghan children.
This is War News Radio. In 2003, Sergeant Chuck signed up to serve with the U.S. military in Operation Iraqi Freedom. His time there proved difficult, and trying to win hearts and minds in Iraq's Sunni triangle was a constant frustration. Madeline Abramowitz has the story.
Chuck is a 35-year-old sergeant in the Army National Guard. Back in the 90s, he served a tour in Bosnia. There, he formed a strong bond with his fellow soldiers. When they got home, they went to college together and were best men at each other's weddings. In 2002, Chuck's friends were called to Iraq. He signed up to join them. He said he couldn't bear the thought of being left behind. And he couldn't wait to see Iraq.
Sounds flaky to a whole lot of people, but that's kind of how I was feeling for it. I just wanted to go to the Middle East, the cradle of civilization right there. I was like, Baghdad, wow.
During his year-long rotation, Chuck, who asked us not to use his last name, was attached to the 4th Infantry Division, 1st Brigade. The 4th ID entered Iraq from Kuwait in April 2003, and Chuck rotated between units in the northern cities of Mosul, Beji, and Tikrit. As a sergeant in the Psychological Operations Unit, he spent a lot of time talking to people. He'd go to a village outside the city, often somewhere American troops had never been, and figure out who lived there and what they needed. Through a translator, Chuck would talk to everyone from mayors and imams to shopkeepers and kids on the street. It's a routine he was used to from his civilian job back home.
Yeah, I'm a police officer up in the Cleveland area. I have to credit that job, actually, for I think what I was able to do in Iraq, or you know what I mean? I kind of brought that mentality with me, not so much of a gangbusters kind of storming the beachhead mentality. I'm a patrol cop. You know what I mean? That's what I do. I turn around, talk to people. Some people say, hey, there's some drug dealers going on in here. We're tired of it, blah, blah, blah. You know what I mean? I cruise around. I talk to people.
The combat troops that Chuck's unit was supporting took a more aggressive approach. They were operating in the violent Sunni Triangle, the northwestern swath of Iraq that was a hotbed of resistance during the first years of the war. It was Chuck's brigade that eventually found and captured Saddam Hussein outside Tikrit. And for the first 9 months of his tour, American troops swarmed the region, searching for Saddam. They treated the local Iraqis roughly, pointing their weapons at people in the street, driving cars off the road, and raiding houses and rounding up all the men. When the army would do night raids, Chuck would be there in his Humvee. His job was to broadcast messages on a loudspeaker, telling the inhabitants what was happening and urging them not to resist. Night after night, he'd sit in his vehicle and watch.
In the houses in Iraq, they'd have a wall surrounding them, and they'd have like a metal door, and then you'd enter there, and then that would be like the yard, and then the actual house itself. And they'd bust down the steel wall there, and then everybody would file in, kind of like you'd probably see, SWAT teams in the States doing it, and then enter and search the place, sometimes detain the males, take them outside is usually what would happen.
After a while, Chuck started feeling uncomfortable with the way Iraqis were being treated. The aggression looked counterproductive.
Yeah, I was disenchanted with how the raids went, though, a lot of times. 3 a.m., taking a family out of a house and putting the father, putting a hood on his head and flex cuffing him and putting him on his knees in front of his family. I'm like, yeah, we just created an enemy there. You know what I mean? And you see that over and over again, and you're like, wow, that's not going to turn out good for us. That guy's sons are going to hate us, and that guy's sons are going to hate us. And that, you know what I mean? I started doubting, what exactly is our aim here? Are we just night after night going to kick in doors and piss people off? Is that our strategy,
As the first year of the war progressed, Chuck noticed changes in the way that Iraqis reacted to him and the other Americans. People in the streets and markets were less willing to talk to him, more likely to get angry. Most of the time, when a particular neighborhood suddenly turned cold towards the Americans, it only took a little asking around to figure out why.
Come to find out, maybe there was, you know, maybe somebody got rolled up in a raid or something and that pissed them off, or maybe, you know, a convoy had gone through there and ran some cars off the road, and then, oh, okay, that's why.
But sometimes their anger would take him by surprise. In November, CBS's Kimberly Dozier came to interview Chuck in a marketplace that he knew well. The people there had always been indifferent towards him, or cool at worst. But with the cameras on them, they showed another side.
All of a sudden, they were chanting behind us, fists raised, and seemed very angry. It could have also been because playing it up for, there's a TV camera, you know. But I remember it kind of took me by surprise because I was, you know, I've been here a bunch of times and this has never happened before.
It took until the end of 2006, when Chuck was back in the States, for the U.S. military to change its approach. American troops ran fewer night raids, took prisoners more selectively, and concentrated on winning the trust of Iraqi civilians. Chuck kept in touch with his friends who stayed in Iraq, and he says the change they saw was dramatic.
A lot of the attitude when I was in Iraq was, screw it, we're here, we have the biggest guns, and, you know, this is our yard and we're going to run it how we want. That was kind of the prevailing mentality when I was there. Watching it a couple of years later, it was almost like a different war, you know, and I had a couple of friends that had come back, you know what I mean, that had come back, and the disparity between, like, my tour and theirs was pretty great.
Now Chuck is on tour in Afghanistan, where he's managing the distribution of humanitarian aid. He says the strategy there seems a lot closer to the hearts and minds tactics the military is using in Iraq right now, and he feels a lot more at ease.
It is night and day compared to Iraq. We're more cognizant of subtleties and nuances and you know, people's perceptions of us and things of that nature a lot more. I feel a lot better. I don't have the heartburn here that I did back then.
As the United States military shifts attention from Iraq to Afghanistan after 6 years, Chuck's story suggests that our success, or failure, may depend as much on how we deal with Afghan civilians as on the number of troops we put there. As for Chuck, he's looking forward to returning home in a year and taking his 4-year-old to Disneyland. For War News Radio, I'm Madeline Abramowitz.
This is War News Radio. At the start of the Iraq War, some journalists chose to travel as embedded reporters with the military. They saw the day-to-day grind of war and conflict, and brought back important and powerful stories, perspectives, and images. Samia Abbas talks to one photojournalist who has reported on the war from the outset, and is about to begin a new project focused on Iraqi refugees.
She's seen Palestinian militants engage in target practice in the Palestinian-occupied territories, traveled across the Chadian border into Darfur with the Sudanese Liberation Army, and witnessed Operation Iraqi Freedom from the front lines. Alyssa Everett has seen a lot of conflict, and she's had to contend with plenty of dangerous obstacles in the process. But it wasn't always this way.
In 2002, I decided to quit my job in investment banking and pursue my photography full-time as a profession. I went to the Middle East and was traveling, working on my portfolio. At that point, it was obvious the war was going to happen, and decided that I wanted to cover the war in Iraq.
A New York City-based photojournalist and reporter, Everett has had her work published in the Sunday Times of London, The Economist, Associated Press, and the San Francisco Chronicle, among others. She was featured on the CW Network's In Harm's Way War Photographers. She's been on assignments in the Middle East, the Americas, Europe, and Africa. In 2007, she co-founded a nonprofit organization called Care Through Action that works to raise money for victims of humanitarian crises around the world.
I obviously didn't have any credentials in kind of starting from scratch, so I ended up buying a car in Amman, Jordan, and driving across the border into Iraq. I spent quite a bit of time on the ground interviewing different platoons of soldiers that I would come across.
But Everett's career first started when she went to Iraq as a freelance journalist at the start of the war. Everett eventually became an embedded journalist with the 101st Airborne Division in northern Iraq. After 2 months with them, she spent another 6 months traveling around Iraq and interviewing Iraqis. In the beginning of the war, she spoke to many Iraqis who were happy that the Americans had come.
They were excited that Saddam was gone. They were excited by the promise of freedom and being able to live their lives freely. Thus, as an American journalist, I was welcomed into people's houses. They were curious. They offered meals. They offered me places to stay.
But that changed as the war went on, and the situation started to get worse for civilians.
There was more questioning about what was the purpose of this war. Why were the Americans there? Their conditions were actually worse than they were under Saddam. They had no electricity, often breaks in running water. And then the crime started becoming really rampant, and it became very dangerous for Iraqis in their own homes. And they started being angry and frustrated. By the time that I left in December of 2003, it was not very safe for an American to be out alone on the street.
Traveling in a war zone, Everett had to deal with several challenges. For one thing, she had never had any journalism experience before. For another, she's a woman.
Some of the biggest challenges for me in conflict zones have to do with being female. I would say that access is a little bit more difficult if you're embedded or trying to embed with either a group of nationals wherever I'm covering a conflict or American soldiers. They tend to believe that women can't handle these situations as well as men can. And then there's always the threat of violence against women.
Everett's travels as a journalist and photographer have illuminated several important things for her about reporting during wartime.
The death and despair side gets reported quite a bit, but the hope and inspiration was not.
Especially in this war, she thinks a crucial voice is missing and has been from the beginning.
All of the media that we see coming out of that war is pretty much exclusively from the American military soldier perspective. We just don't see a lot coming out that really humanizes Iraqis and talks about what their situation is and how most civilians feel.
In all of the places she's traveled, Everett has found humanity in the face of overwhelming odds. Seeing the Iraq War and other violence has taught her about conflict and its place in a human world.
I honestly look at war as kind of a human condition. I think that humans engage in conflict in every aspect of their life, and war is just a larger conflict that we engage in on a larger scale. Honestly, I don't see a world on Earth with humans and no war.
It has informed her image of this war in particular.
I'm very anti the war in Iraq. I think it was a mistake to go there, and I think we've caused far more harm than we have done good. So I guess in that sense, I'm anti-war, but I don't see a world without war.
But she isn't bitter. Everett finds that journalism, especially photography, has the power to bring important events to the world's attention.
You know, in today's shortened attention span world, I think imagery becomes even more important, where you can look at one face and it will tell you a story. It's that old saying that a picture is worth a thousand words.
She tries to drop her expectations when she goes to a conflict zone. That way, she can be open to the experience without letting other factors influence her and do a better job as a reporter. Everett speaks of one trip to Darfur.
I was anticipating finding devastation and death and destruction and really severe conditions. And what I found there were a lot of people that were trying to survive, that were living and surviving and going day to day, but they were smile and laugh and talk to you and offer you their last cup of tea.
In October, Everett will join a group of artists specializing in different mediums to interview Iraqi refugees living in Jordan, Lebanon, and Syria. They're going as part of the Iraqi Voices Amplification Project, or IVAP. It's run by Intersections, a multi-faith coalition of churches that works globally to promote peace, justice, and reconciliation.
The focus of this project is to raise awareness around the conditions of these Iraqi refugees and to create bodies of work that will become moving exhibitions throughout the United States. Visit colleges, universities, different schools, museums and really talk about what's happening with these Iraqi refugees and the question of what kind of moral obligation do we have to help them.
For Everett, the importance of her job is keeping people aware of what's going on in Iraq and the world.
Unfortunately, I think that people nowadays don't read all the text. They won't sit down and take time to read the newspaper, but they'll watch TV, watch imagery. They'll look at a picture printed on the front page of the New York Times rather than picking up the paper and reading the entire paper. So I think it plays an incredibly important role.
Everett's work underscores the power of imagery in an increasingly fast-paced world, one that constantly poses a challenge to journalists as they try to reach the public. For War News Radio, I'm Samia Abbas.
This is War News Radio. It's no secret that Afghan schools are desperately short on supplies. But what do these schools really have? Sarah Dwyer tells us more.
Mustafa Wardock is a student at the American University in Kabul who spent the summer helping to improve classrooms around the country. As he traveled from province to province, he met with teachers and experienced Afghan classrooms outside the more privileged cities. He explains what Afghan students are doing as they get ready to head back to school.
Some schools, they really want to buy bags. They really want to buy, like, pencils, all these things, like all these stationery materials and all this stuff. But up to some point, UNICEF, which is a United Nations organization, they really help in notebooks. They really help to these schools because all over Afghanistan, you can find the UNICEF textbooks, whatever if you are in Kabul or whatever if you are in Kandahar, whatever if you are in Ghazni. They only give these textbooks to the students, UNICEF.
But since textbooks cover limited subjects, many students crave information beyond the classroom. Wardock's job involved delivering supplies to Afghan classrooms. He received many requests.
Some schools, they have a few computers, which is like funded by some NGO, but it's in Kabul. I'm only selling in Kabul. They have some computers, but they don't have any access to internet because basically internet is something very new nowadays and that kind of stuff. But in provinces, whenever we go to a training, whenever me and Marian goes, the second thing that after science they are really requesting is, especially they are requesting for the computers, and they are saying, if you have computers and all the stuff, so can you please help us? We can make like solar panels and all the stuff. We can have electricity, but we don't know how to use a computer and internet. So basically, they're quite interested in these two things. Internet, absolutely no. None of the schools in Kabul or in Afghanistan have access to internet. Yeah, computers in Kabul, some schools have, but not in other provinces.
Outside the classroom, Wardock says it's hard for students to find good places to play and have fun.
They have the playgrounds, but the playgrounds are all just like, it is like dust. It's full of dust. All of them have playgrounds. Like most of the schools in Afghanistan, when I went there, they have playgrounds in Kabul, especially. And the other districts, like they don't have like these playgrounds because the school itself is located at the top of a mountain. So how can make a playground in there? Sometimes they only play soccer in there or some other sport. So the provinces mostly they don't have any playgrounds. Yes, in Kabul and here, a lot of schools have playgrounds, but that playgrounds are only dust. I saw the playground of Amani High School, which is like donated by the German government. That is only like they have a good grass, they have a basketball court, they have a football, athletics, and these three things. Yeah.
The school day in Afghanistan looks very different from a school day in America.
It is only where we have the first boys section. It is from 7 up to 12. From 7 o'clock, it starts from 7, and it ends at 12 o'clock at noon. So that is finished. So, like, you don't have, like, any lunch break inside, like, all these things. After that, then from 1 o'clock up to 5 o'clock, it's another session, the girls' session. So they come to study. So that's their session. So basically, they don't have lunch break.
After school, students love to play sports.
they really prefer to play cricket because it's getting very famous in there. And the second thing is, I hope that the news, like Afghanistan recently beat Holland and won the international. So they basically, like, they are getting interesting in this game, but they really don't know how to play. But they are, like, trying to, because, like, the year before last, when I was here in Afghanistan and I was studying at the university at the same time, I came here, I saw there is a big ground, which is called Tamani Huji, which the Taliban, I think you might have seen it in the news, the Taliban used to, like, torture the people and they have to hang up to death. So that is the place that they used to play football in it. So for last, when I came, they were all playing football. But this year and the last year, when I go there mostly on Sunday, on Friday, so they are all playing cricket. So that is a big change in here. They really prefer to play cricket.
Though resources are scarce and learning is difficult in the provincial schools, Wardock has witnessed firsthand the drive Afghan students have to learn beyond the classroom. For War News Radio, I'm Sarah Dwider.
This is War News Radio. The prospects for youth in Afghanistan at times seem especially bleak. Almost half of Afghan youth don't attend school. Those who do only go for a few hours a day and are taught by underqualified teachers. But in Kabul, a very unconventional charity is trying to brighten the future of Afghan children. Kyle Gechner-Wald brings us more on Skatistan, a program that teaches both skateboarding and life skills to the next generation of Afghans.
In 2007, Oliver Perkovich followed his girlfriend at the time, Sharna Nolan, from Australia, to her new job in Kabul. In his spare time, Perkovich began skateboarding around the capital and introduced the sport to his Afghan friends. He discovered that it was a wonderful tool for connecting with the local youth.
Right from the start, it was just skateboarding with a few kids. I only had 3 skateboards in the country, and we lent them to Afghan friends at the time, and they were enthusiastic about it. And that just led me to think that perhaps skateboarding could be used as a tool to work with youth and to connect with this very large segment of the population. 68% is under the age of 25 in Afghanistan.
Mirwais Mohsen was one of the first Afghans to skate with Perkovich. He had only returned a year earlier from living as a refugee in Pakistan. Mohsen remembers the first time Sharna Nolan introduced him to skateboarding.
Sharna bring 3 skateboards to Kabul. Then once a week we were just learning the basics. We've seen lots of children there. Yeah, they were too happy, like they've never seen such a thing before.
Inspired by the potential of skateboarding as a means to reach children, Perkovich began the Skatistan program in early 2007. At first, the program encountered financial difficulties, and Perkovich maxed out his credit cards, trying to keep the program afloat. But after several donations from Western embassies, Skatistan was able to steadily work towards its goals. Skatistan is not just meant to provide a recreational outlet for the children of Kabul. Perkovich explains that skating fosters a civil society by teaching the next generation of Afghans cooperation and tolerance.
We're very, very focused on building trust between us as the international effort and the Afghan population. We believe very firmly that without this trust between people, also between different ethnicities, nothing is possible. You can't have outcomes in education. You can't have outcomes in rule of law or in healthcare.
The program is also unique because it brings together rich and poor children who otherwise wouldn't interact. In fact, Skatistan has made a point of employing street children as helpers and instructors. But perhaps most importantly, Skatistan allows girls to participate in a sport, something that is rare in a society that cloisters girls away after the age of 13.
It's very, very important that girls are taught from a young age that they can play a very important role in developing civil society and they can also do things better than boys sometimes, and we've shown that through all of our skate programs. Whenever we have a competition up to the age of 12, the girls are usually better than the boys.
For the most part, Afghans seem to approve of Skatistan's mission. Perkovic says that this is largely due to Skatistan's respectful approach. Skatistan's mission is not to import Western culture, but simply to provide a positive outlet for youth.
We're not looking to introduce any sort of Western culture to Afghanistan. We're not looking to introduce any Western skateboarding culture at all to Afghanistan. All it is a board with four wheels. And it's amazing just to see the kids interpret it, because they don't have any conceptions of how it should be done. And so this is pure skateboarding Afghan style.
Despite a tactful approach, some Kabul residents are still suspicious of skateboarding. Shams Razi, an Afghan skateboarding instructor, relates that he has had to convince some of his fellow Afghans on Skatistan's merits.
Some of the people that don't have any educational and like that, and they think that it's a Western sport. And when I explain our project to them that it's not just skateboarding, we want to teach them that how to deal with the pupils and how to be in a family. After that, when I talked with them, and they was just become very smooth, and they said that it's a good idea, and they become very happy.
Because Skatistan has received so much international attention, it was finally able to secure enough funding to build an indoor facility, which is expected to open soon. Perkovic explains that this new building will be used for much more than skateboarding.
We've got two classrooms that will be air-conditioned with high-speed internet. We've got an office upstairs, and then male and female the room and showers and toilets. And in that, the program that we're going to have is for 30 students at a time, and they'll do a two-hour session, and they'll do firstly 1 hour of education and cultural activities, and then 1 hour of skateboarding. And we're looking to support them with what they're actually learning at school, and we're not looking to change what they're learning at all. It has to be led by what they're interested in.
After an uncertain beginning, it seems that at least for now, Skatistan is a success. However, Perkovic knows that in a country like Afghanistan, nothing is certain, and the organization must begin to rely on private donors.
We're also looking to make ourselves not dependent on the major donors and the governments here, because they might not provide support one day. So it's very important to get support from people all over the world so that we can really continue on over the next 10 years, when perhaps some of the governments might be gone in 1, 2, or 5 years' time.
Perkovic hopes that once Skatistan trains enough personnel, it will be able to branch out to other cities in Afghanistan, though that is still a ways off. He also adds that if anybody could donate wood for skateboard ramps, it would be greatly appreciated. For War News Radio, this is Kyle Gechner-Wald.
That's our show for this week.
War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College.
Visit us online to listen to archive shows, learn more about the program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's at warnewsradio.org.
On our site, you can also comment on this show or on our past programs.
Our behind-the-scenes crew this week includes Emily Hager, Lucas Janes, Gabriel Ramirez, and Abdullah Mizied. I'm Cyrus Stoller.
And I'm Jared Nolan. Until next time, thanks for listening.